From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Jessica Decca Mitford's reactions to world events often pitted her against members of her own family. She eventually left England and made America her home, but she was an avid letter writer, which kept her friends and family abreast of her many adventures. A comprehensive collection of her correspondence, Decca, the Letters of Jessica Mitford, 744 pages in length, has just been published by Knopf, and it brings her daughter Constancia Dinky Romilly and the book's editor, Peter Y. Sussman, to our show today. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Peter, how did you meet Decca?
I met her because she was always very encouraging of young people. And when I was in my 20s and living in Berkeley, California, I was working on a project investigating a paramilitary group. And she just called me one day and said, "I'm so fascinated in what you're working in. Come and tell me about it."
Had you discussed publishing a collection of her letters before she died?
No. In fact, I had no idea that she had such an extensive collection of letters. I had received a note or two. I was a journalist and had received a note or two of encouragement over the years from her and knew her for all of those years, but I had never had any idea. And one day, a few years after she died, her husband, Bob Truhaft, called me and said, "We'd like you to do Decca's letters." Simple as that. I said, "What letters exist?" And he took me over to his house, and there was a treasure trove. Maya Angelou, Catherine Graham, all of these wonderful letters, and I was on.
That means reading an awful lot of letters to decide which ones to include.
Exactly. There were thousands that I didn't include. She had just a voluminous correspondence, and I think lived through letters in some ways.
And Constancia, did she write letters to you?
Oh, yes. She wrote to all of us, myself, my brother, my children, everyone. She used to get up early in the morning and come down and in her dressing gown and have a whole pot full of coffee and start her correspondence for the day.
It's hard to imagine today with people perhaps banging out a few emails, but not much else. Now, her nickname was Decca. Your nickname is Dinky.
Right.
Is this something in the family, or is this something that would have been understood as part of the whole environment?
Well, nicknames are a big thing in her family. In fact, they're a big thing in England. I think if you meet English people, you often find out that they have a kind of a funny nickname. So it was inevitable that we would end up with nicknames.
Well, Dinky, Decca sounds like, I guess I can see that from Jessica.
Yeah, it came from Jessica. I came from Dinky the Democratic Donkey, because my mother was pregnant with me in 1940, was taken by her good friend Virginia Durr to the convention in Chicago, and the Texas delegates were there drunk and cracking jokes all the time, and they said my mother's morning sickness was evidence of the Democratic donkey kicking up a fuss. I was called Dinky Donkey or Dinky Donk or the Donk forever after.
Well, what was her relationship with her parents like after she'd run away to Spain and then to America?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I knew virtually nothing about all of this amazing family. We lived in a sort of lower middle class neighborhood in Oakland, and my mother would talk from time to time, but for me as a little girl,
the family mansion
she would talk about this family, but it was like reading Alice in Wonderland or something to me. So it wasn't until I was a teenager that I actually got to England and got to see what it was that she was talking about.
And she never talked about the sisters?
She talked about her sisters.
The conflicts within the family?
She mentioned them from time to time more as I got older. But it wasn't a big part of my childhood. Remember, she didn't start writing, which is when all of this really kind of, you know, came out again, until I was already out of the house and gone away to college. Her first book was published in 1960. I was in college by that time. And that's when it all this attention on her family and her background began to come in on us.
And she was 43 at the time.
And was this a revelation for you, Constanza? I mean, I didn't know that. Mom, why did you tell me that?
No. It was more of a mystery than a revelation.
Now, Peter, she is very witty in her correspondence, but she doesn't come across as all that introspective. Was humor her way of dealing with the world?
I think it's one of her ways. She was very socially committed, and she was very intelligent about perceiving social inequities and social and hypocrisy. The American Way of Death, which is her great book, was a way of she was able to see through the sham and hypocrisy, and that is a form of insightfulness, which is unusual. I think maybe has to do with her dual nationality.
She's an insider and an outsider at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And she could see things with eyes that we couldn't see. I mean, the whole idea of burying a corpse in cushion-soled shoes. And she would look at this and she'd, you know, where are they walking, you know? But this is something we had taken for granted, the whole embalming thing.
You know, says she wasn't introspective. This is a big thing that people are always saying about my mother. But if you look at the letters that she wrote to my children and to myself when I was in college, you do see a certain amount of kind of self-awareness and introspection that you didn't see so much in public life.
Well, you mentioned the cushion-soled shoes. Of course, it takes somebody who comes out of an eccentric situation to see eccentricity in others, and her family was definitely eccentric.
But it was not considered eccentric in this country to bury someone in cushion-soled shoes, and she had to see there's something odd about this.
She grew up in a situation where the kids developed a secret language.
Yes. Each set had their own, you know, little language with each other.
How did that come about?
Well, you have to recognize you had seven children living in a isolated environment, didn't go to school except for the one boy, were just at home learning to read. Their mother taught them how to read. So they were thrown on their own devices a great deal. And I think that there are a lot of families where you see this, where the family members develop their own secret kind of language or way of relating to each other because of that isolation.
Did you get to know your aunts?
Yes, I did, especially the youngest, Debo, who's the only one that's still living. She and I are good friends, and I see her from time to time. The others were a bit more aloof. Pam was not of particularly interested in me nor I of her. Nancy, well known for her cruelty, was cruel. I felt she was cruel to me. But Debo
was the
one.
She had the sharpest tongue.
She had a sharp tongue, and she loved to use it and see what was the reaction going to be. Whereas Debo's idea was to try to envelop the family, try to be friends with all the members of the family, try to get to know these mysterious American children who must have been just as bizarre to us, to her as she was to us.
Weren't the girls at Reedsdale, the daughters of Lord and Lady Reedsdale, weren't they written about in the British press in much the same way that someone like Paris Hilton might be written about today?
Yes, like like Paris Hilton, or maybe more like the Kennedys, as a kind of important, not political, but yet political family of Britain.
Well, one of her greatest regrets, your mother's greatest regrets in life, was her lack of education. You said that they were homeschooled, but barely. Why?
Why were they?
Weren't they? I mean, other young women of the time were sent to schools.
Well, Favre and Mauve, my grandparents, were completely opposed to sending girls to school. They didn't see the point of it. The girls were going to end up marrying suitable young men and running country estates, and to go to school was not something they needed to do.
And what Decca and her sisters had complicated feelings about their mother, some even stating through correspondence that they actively disliked her. What was Decca's take on her mother?
Well, that was Deck who said she actively disliked her mother in writing, in actually talking about how one's views of one's parents change over time. And she was saying that as a child, and particularly as a teenager, she actively loathed her mother for not letting her go to school, whereas when she got older, she began to see the more positive aspects of her mother and rather adored her in the end.
So she tried to reconcile with her later. But she also, I'm sure that politics played a part in dividing the family.
Well, politics, I mean, it started with school, and then it went to politics.
Lady Reedsdale is someone who described Hitler as, above all, a person of heart. I think that speaks for itself.
Well, in going through these letters, Peter, on the one hand, there's the personal aspect, and I'm sure that you found that fascinating, the family story. But this is also a history of the world throughout a very eventful time. She lived from 1918 to, what,
96.
So that
was and she was at the center of a lot of things. She was at the center of the civil rights movement. She was in New Deal, Washington, in a home, living in the home of Virginia Durr, which was virtually the social center of the New Deal. She would commute into Washington with John Kenneth Galbraith and people like that. She had an extensive list of correspondents and friends on two continents, if not more. And she... and she was very good at reporting on it. When she was in Washington and her first husband, who died in the war, was in training with the Royal Canadian Air Force, she would talk about the tension between those who wanted to enter World War II and those who didn't. So you certainly got a sense of the history in passing, and she was a very keen observer. So she really caught a lot of that.
She was a marvelous reporter. She was really a good reporter.
When did you become a communist?
In the 30s.
No. So was she a good communist
in
the way that people followed the line? Oh, she 43.
Yeah,
oh,
it was 43, and she left in 58.
So that was...
Well, she signed on the line, but she was she was working in communist causes in the 30s when she went to Spain with my father.
Now, that your father was Robert Truhaft.
My stepfather is Robert Truhaft. My father was Esmond Romilly.
Oh, right. But Robert Truhaft, your stepfather, was also a communist, wasn't
he? That's right.
And it's interesting to note that Hillary Rodham Clinton worked at his law firm as an intern when she was at law school, but he had already left the party by then, I'm sure.
I don't think that Hillary likes to be reminded of that.
Well,
you'll have to ask her. Invite her on the show.
A lot of their work in the party was wonderful, wonderful civil rights work. And it's easy to mischaracterize that party membership now in retrospect as supporter of Stalin or whatever it was. But their day-to-day life was working with the victims of racism in the streets of Oakland.
But it's such an odd situation. We have Unity, her sister, who's an intimate friend of Adolf Hitler, whom she adored. In fact, she shot herself in the head on the day that Britain declared war on Germany, and then, I guess, lived in an institution because of the brain damage that it caused.
She wasn't institutionalized most of that time, but she was brain damaged, and
She lived with my grandmother. My grandmother took care of her.
And then Diana was married to the British fascist leader, Sir Oswald Mosley.
That's right.
And she spent part of World War II in prison while their second cousin, Winston Churchill, was prime minister.
Deborah married very well, became the Duchess of Devonshire and chatelaine of the great English country house Chatsworth. And then, of course, Nancy wrote some of those incredible comic novels, even if she had a sharp, mean tongue. Pam was the only one who lived a conventional life. What happened?
Yeah, who knows?
Just to be different, or would we say that Jessica was moved so far to the left to be different, to get away from that crazy family?
Well, who can say why it is that one child turns one way politically and another child turns another? But Deck was always sympathetic with at that time with what she saw as poor people living in her environment, and later people who were her neighbors and clients of my father, of my stepfather. And as Peter said, their work, the two of them were devoted to ending police brutality in Oakland, to ending segregation in the school system, which people may not realize that the school system in Oakland was also quite segregated in those years in the 50s.
Still is to some degree, simply because there are a few white people in Oakland.
Still is. And defending the First Amendment, which was one of Deck's primary themes that went through her life. And she just couldn't abide the upper class support of reaction of fascism that her sisters and her family represented. Now, why? I wouldn't begin to be able to tell you, but that's the way it ended up.
But she also didn't take advantage of the fact that there was a lot of money in the family.
Well, I don't think that she really could have taken advantage. I mean, she was written out of her father's will. She did try to take advantage of inheriting a little piece of an island, which she inherited by accident. She wanted to sell her portion and give the money to the Communist Party of Britain. But needless to say, the Communist Party of Britain wasn't particularly interested in having a little piece of a tiny little Hebridean island with nothing but sheep on it. So that didn't go too far.
The obvious question is, have you gained different perspectives on her by reading the correspondence, Peter?
I think I knew her, well, you obviously do in many subtle ways and in many important ways, but I knew her through her life in Oakland and through her life as a writer. So for me, the extent to which she reestablished and maintained a correspondence and friendship with her English family was a revelation to me.
Quickly.
Well, she's always been my hero. I never fell out with her, and now even more so than ever, thanks to Peter's wonderful editorial job on this book.
But reading the book, you saw things that were even more admirable than you had imagined?
She was a remarkable, astonishing woman. Funny, sad. Run out. Buy the book. You'll see. See for yourself.
Constancia Romilly and Peter Sussman will be giving a talk, reading letters and signing books tomorrow at noon and at 7 o'clock at the General Society of Mechanics and Tradesmen Library. That's at 20 West 44th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. For reservations, you can call 212-921-1767. The book, DECA, The Letters of Jessica Mitford, edited by Peter Y. Sussman, is published by Knopf. And I thank the both of you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.